Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time. In each episode of this podcast, we invite a special guest to take us on a tailored tour of the past. Travels Through Time is brought to you in partnership with History Today, Britain's best-loved serious history magazine. You can read articles relating to this podcast and more about our guests at historytoday.com/travels. There is also a special subscription offer for Travels Through Time listeners. 3 issues for just £1 each.
I never knew the time my heart looked freely from my brow. It once was checked by timidness, 'tis taught by caution now. I live among the cold, the false, and I must seem like them. And such I am, for I am false, as those I most condemn. I teach my lip its sweetest smile, my tongue its softest tone. I borrow others' likeness, till almost I lose my own.
You're listening to an extract of a poem that was written by one of the most celebrated figures of the London literary scene in the 1820s. Her career began within a few years of the death of John Keats, and it finished at about the time that Charles Dickens made his reputation with the Pickwick Papers. Her name is Letitia Landon, and she's the subject of this episode of Travels Through Time. I'm Peter Moore, and welcome to the podcast where we invite a special guest to tell a historical story by exploring one year in the past through 3 different scenes. Today's guest is the literary historian and journalist Dr. Lucasta Miller. She's best known, until now that is, as the author of The Bronte Myth, a great sweeping history of the entire Bronte story. This month, her second book is being released, L.E.L., The Lost Life and Scandalous Death of Letitia Elizabeth Landon, the celebrated female Byron, is a fascinating blend of literary scholarship and biographical excavation. It's been called riveting and absorbing, and having just read it, I can testify to the fact that it brings to life a vivid and often overlooked figure in our literary history. Letitia Landon was a true celebrity in her time. I caught up with Lucasta at her publisher's in London the other day. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Lucasta.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's get started. We're going to be using the year 1838 as our destination. But first, I want to talk more broadly about English literary world, or the English literary world, in the opening half of the 19th century. What really entices you towards it?
For me as a historian, the thing about this era that has made it really, really difficult but also intriguing to research is that it was an era of extreme hypocrisy, which means that the sources are really hard to deal with.
When you say hypocrisy, can you explain a little bit more what you mean by that? What was the hypocrisy?
Absolutely. There's sexual hypocrisy, financial hypocrisy, and corruption. This was an era in which, as Letitia Landon herself put it in a poem, none among us dares to say what none will choose to hear. But actually, you know, even in her own private letters, Letitia Landon tells lies. And it's really, really difficult to get to grips with a whole society where people don't really want to admit what's going on. And also where, after her death, there is an absolutely concerted, calculated cover-up about her story by the literary establishment. What really drew me to this particular period is that it's a bit of a no man's land in the history of English literature. Everybody knows who the Romantics were, and everybody knows who the Victorians were. But in between, there's this rather odd black hole, which has been described as a strange pause and an indeterminate borderland. Mm. One literary historian once described it as a tedious flat calm in which nothing much happened. He could not have got it more wrong. This was a literary era in which grievous bodily harm was not unknown as a response to a bad book review.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, because having read the book, she comes across as a real shape-shifting character, someone who's difficult to pin down. And even if I think of describing her as a romantic now, it doesn't seem to quite fit, does it?
No, it doesn't. She's a total shape-shifter. And this intervening era is really an era in many ways of masquerade. And that's one of the reasons why it's been so incredibly difficult for literary historians really to analyse analyse it because the voices of the writers of the time are so sort of tonally shifting and peculiar and very difficult for the modern reader to grasp. There are lots of reasons for that, and one of them, I think, is to do with the literary market and the fact that the market itself meant that lots of writers were working in ephemeral forms, like periodicals, annuals, as they were known.
Right, so if we were going to put this in chronological terms, are we saying really the death of Byron? And what year
was
that?
Yeah, I mean, so Keats dies 1821, Shelley 1822, Byron 1824.
And those are the late romantics.
So those are the late romantics. And then you get this gap until Dickens starts coming along in the late 1830s. But also, and what makes my subject, Letitia Landon, so interesting, is that you have this sort of period of cultural transition, so that she publishes her first poem in 1820 when Keats, Byron, Shelley are still alive and we're in the world of Regency rakes and romantic rebels. By the time she dies in 1838, Victoria is on the throne and Dickens is sort of shaping up to turn the image of the writer into something that conforms with sort of Victorian family values rather than the transgressive figure of Byron.
So we have before us a really intriguing character. So let's talk a little bit about her, because she was a real celebrity, wasn't she? Especially at the start of her career, which was in the early 1820s.
Yes, in fact, when she first started to publish, she was a mystery character, and the whole sort of reason why she became a minor cult figure was that nobody really knew who she was. She published only under her initials, L.E.L., a series of poems, as I said, in this magazine called The Literary Gazette. The editor did admit that the author of these poems was a lady yet in her teens, which excited readers further. And for example, Edward Bulwer Lytton, when he was an undergraduate at Cambridge at that period, he describes how in the reading room of the Union, he and his fellow young blades would be fighting over the Literary Gazette to find the latest poem by L.E.L. If you only knew L.E.L.'s reputation in the 20th century, which was as a sort of naive, virginal schoolgirl, you would not understand at all why she was popular among young men in Cambridge in 1822. And from the very start, her voice was extremely ambiguous. She wrote poetry that was written in the language of sort of flowers and birds, actually rather like Keats. Some people read these poems as being the innocent work of an ingenue. Other people read them as dark metaphors for sex and suicide.
So if we were in that common room in Cambridge, how often are we getting an instalment of L.E.L.'s latest?
From 1820 for about a year and a half, it's near weekly.
Right.
And then in 1824, she comes out from behind the veil of the anonymity of the initials and publishes a bestseller, which is called The Improvisatrice. Again, you know, suggesting that she's improvising her own identity. And at this moment, the editor of the Literary Gazette, who is by now her sort of agent and impresario, is puffing her wildly as the new Byron.
We'll get to him in just a moment, because he's a character in his own right that we should certainly deal with. But I love the way you describe the slipperiness of her poetic identity in terms of style, voice, and viewpoint. Reflected a fundamental reality that as a woman, her subjectivity and autonomy were under constant threat. So you've got the dovetailing here of literary culture and women's place in the 19th century world. And I imagine this, how did he describe the editor in his opening allusion?
A lady yet in her teens.
Yeah, that's a very calculated description of
In fact, the construction of L.E.L. was quite consciously done, I think, on his part. L.E.L. was not just a poet. L.E.L. was a poetic brand. And Letitia Landon, of course, goes along with this. But on the other hand, you can often tell that her poetry is slipping and sliding in ways that suggest that she has a critical perspective at the same time.
And just to put this anonymity in context, because I was thinking of Boz, you know, when you were... This is like another literary construct of similar years, which Dickens uses. We have the famous sketches by Boz, which come on maybe a decade afterwards.
I think what was going on when L.E.L. was invented... William Jerdon, the editor, was actually probably influenced by the fact that Walter Scott had become the greatest selling novelist of his era by becoming the great unknown. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of stuff in the papers about who is he, and he was hoping that everybody would be saying about L.E.L., who is she, which indeed many of them were.
Yeah, I suppose today the closest parallel we can think of is it with the Ferrante novels, which came out recently, the level of intrigue that was generated by the mystique of the writer.
Yes,
I suppose in a way this is...
That's interesting, but I think I see the Ferrante novels as being a little bit more like when Charlotte Bronte published Jane Eyre in 1847, because the novels themselves have a sort of autobiographical feel of authenticity that Eliel doesn't really have. Her poetry is often about very extreme emotions, but I don't see her as expressing herself. I see her as playing a role, and in fact the theatre does play a role in her life too.
Brilliant. I think you're right that behind the scenes she was an indefatigable worker. She was always, I mean, she was disposed to writing poems. And I think you've got a description of her mother saying, this girl is mad about writing poems. She's writing poems.
Yes, addicted.
And there's another very short quote when you just said she was cool. That was part of her allure. It's a very 21st century way of describing it, maybe.
Yeah, I think to the young audience who were reading her when she first came out, partly because, basically, she wrote about sex in under-the-radar ways that even respectable young ladies could read.
Mm. And while this might all sound really exciting, there's a more troubling part to this story, isn't there? And that's in the relationship to the editor of the Literary Gazette. She's how old at this
point? She's 17, 18. They're already having an affair by the time she's publishing. And then by 1824, when she comes out onto the public stage as the acknowledged author of The Improvisatrice, she already has one secret illegitimate baby who has been sort of sent off. Even during this period of her celebrity, she's playing a very, very dangerous game with her own reputation. In her poetry, the words fame and shame occur again and again. And as a woman with a sexual secret like hers, we've got to remember that in those days, the fallen woman was not an accepted figure in society. As you can imagine, when she became acknowledged in public as this author, and she already has one secret illegitimate baby, she's playing a very dangerous game, because this is a society in which a lady cannot be a single mother. The fallen woman is not an accepted figure in society. The words fame and shame are found again and again in her poetry. She's walking a really dangerous tightrope. And then in 1826, the Sunday Times publishes an expose where a charwoman has looked in through the study blinds at William Jerdon's house and seen the couple in flagrante, and sells a story to the Sunday Times. Their names are not mentioned. It's a well-known literary man and a well-known literary woman, but anybody who's anybody in those literary circles in London knows exactly who they are. And this story also exposes the fact that she's already had one child, though it gets the sex of the child wrong. However, she keeps publishing her Byronic poetry of tragic romantic love. She's like a gambler who just loses touch with the dangers, and more she gets sort of bullied and trolled by men in the literary industry in their periodicals, people who are meant to be her colleagues and her peers, who are publishing obscene stuff about her in their papers, and she gets more and more cornered, really.
It's, as you describe it, this persona of the fallen woman is a really difficult one. It seems to be that's what she's battling against, and she's terrified of the label. So there's lots of denials, there's lots of obfuscation.
Absolutely. It's more complicated than that, because in the early poetry, she glamorises the idea of the fallen woman in many of her early poems, and the ones that are written in the Byronic era. As time goes on, she gradually tries to change her image, but it's pretty much too late.
Okay. We now come to the year which is a defining one in many ways in her life. There was other points before, but 1838. And we'll go to our first scene, which is the 7th of June, 1838. It's a long time, it's more than a decade since she burst onto the literary scene. What is happening to Eliel on that day?
Well, we're in St Mary's Church, Bryanston Square, and Eliel is getting married. By this stage, she actually already has three secret illegitimate children with William Jerdon. However, things have really started to go wrong after he's gone bankrupt, finally left his wife, but shacked up with an 18-year-old. By this stage also, Letitia Landon's literary fame is on the slide. She's on the receiving end of all this mockery by men in the press. She's already tried to sort of make a respectable woman of herself by getting married once. She was briefly engaged to John Forster, who's better known today as Dickens's great friend and biographer, but took fright after he received anonymous letters telling him about her sexual history. So she's had this awful experience of one engagement. Now she's had an engagement where finally the man has come to the point and turned up at the church, and he is a most surprising person. He is a man called George MacLean, who is the governor of Cape Coast Castle in West Africa.
Well, there's a lot to investigate here. So, first off, the wedding is a set-piece moment, just in the human story, is a great big thing. Are we imagining, you know, a kind of a church full of people? Or is it a more subdued affair?
Well, two of Letitia Landon's memoirists present this as a love match. It was nothing of the sort, and the reason why they presented it like that was because they'd been instrumental in making the match. This is not a fairy tale wedding at all. There are hardly any guests. After the ceremony, there isn't a reception. The bride and groom go for one night to the Sackville Street Hotel, presumably to consummate the marriage. And then the bride returns to the friends with whom she is living at that time. She actually has no fixed abode by now. And she continues to use her maiden name for over a fortnight. And even the 19-year-old daughter of the couple that she's staying with doesn't find out that their guest, Miss Landon, has got married until she tells her a few weeks later.
So all this plays into a badly arranged wedding. That happens from time to time in the novels, we know. But all this leads us to the obvious question, who is she getting married to?
George MacLean was born in 1801 in the Scottish Highlands. In his early youth, he joined the Royal African Corps, which meant that his entire adult life had been spent a long way away from literary gossip in London. He went first to Sierra Leone, and then in 1830 he was made governor of Cape Coast Castle. In 1836 he'd come home to Britain for a period of home leave, which is when he'd first met Letitia Landon.
So it's a strange coming together of two worlds, isn't it? You've got this public servant who's been off overseas and a poet from literary London. How did they meet in the first place? That seems a strange...
Yes, read her biography, her contemporary biography published in 1841, or read the memoirs. You'll never quite work out exactly how and why this happened. But they were introduced by another slightly shady figure who appears in the story, who's a very wealthy businessman called Matthew Forster, whose company, Forster and Smith, is the biggest British player in the West Africa trade at the time.
And by West Africa trade, we mean?
The West Africa trade is sort of basically import-export. Obviously, before the Abolition Act of 1807, the main trade was the slave trade. Since abolition, some businesses have been trying to grow what was called legitimate trade, which meant in commodities like palm oil and peanuts and mahogany and gold and stuff, rather than in slaves. How Letitia Landon got to know Britain's premier palm oil importer, I don't know. I still can't quite find it out. But by this stage in her life, she is still enough of a literary lion that she's the sort of person who gets invited to parties by people who don't actually know her.
It wasn't a love match, to put it in those quite trite terms. What was the appeal of this bit? Was he an escape for her from a world that she was fed up with?
She'd got to the point in her life where even her female friends were finding her an embarrassment. She was increasingly in debt. She was addicted to drugs. She was emotionally more and more unstable. And people wanted to find a solution to the problem of Letitia.
And we mentioned before, or you mentioned, that she'd had these three children. I think it's probably important to point out that they would have gone. They would have dispersed.
Oh, yes. There's no evidence that I found that she ever saw any of her children again as they grew up.
Yeah, which sounds shocking to us today, but was quite a commonplace thing back then. The children would disappear.
Yes, probably.
Do we know anything about those children?
Yes, because they were in touch with their father in later life, so we do know what happened to them. The situation in West Africa was quite sort of ambiguous and complex. He's actually a transitional figure in very much the same way
that
Letitia is.
This is funny how it kind of tessellates together with the strange pause in literary history that we also have in political history, this strange liminal period where we've had, I suppose, the Georgian years, where the slave trade was one of the great economic forces. That's been abolished. but you've not yet got to the point of the imperial Victorian machine being constructed. Is that right?
That's right. So the sort of governance of this area of West Africa is still under a sort of private-public partnership, a little bit like the East India Company. And George MacLean has actually been appointed not by the British government, but by the Council of Merchants.
Well, we're going to leave the wedding behind now, because I think you've given us enough in this scene to know that this is a big departure in Letitia's life. Things aren't going to be the same because she's going to somewhere else entirely. So your second scene where you'd like to go is just a few months later on. There's been a departure and now we are in Cape Coast Castle and it's late August, summertime of 1838. So a few months later, what's happening there?
So after marrying George MacLean, she goes back to West Africa with him, to Cape Coast Castle, which is in modern-day Ghana. Now, Cape Coast Castle is famous today as a pilgrimage place for African Americans who are looking to explore their heritage. Barack Obama visited it very famously, and he took his family, he took Michelle and the children as well, and he made a very moving speech about how going there reminded him of visiting Buchenwald with Elie Wiesel, because the walls talk.
Does it still
exist? Oh, yes, Cape Coast Castle still very much exists. I've been there. It was the hub of the British slave trade. It was known as the Grand Slave Emporium. It's, in many ways, a very forbidding building, bristling with cannon. It's also a real sort of whited sepulchre because the walls are plastered and painted white, and it's under the ground level that the slave dungeons are, and they are really, really shocking when the guide takes you down.
And, well, you've got Letitia getting there, I suppose. Yeah, this is 150 years ago we're talking about, so the history is much closer at hand for her, and it's a complete disassociation with the world that she knows of West London, where she used to live, the literary life, the parties. Also, there was the added fact that it was a dangerous place for Europeans to go because many of them died quite quickly due to the climate and disease. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, it was known as the white man's grave for a reason. I mean, the local missionary was having real difficulty recruiting people to come out there because they kept dropping like flies.
OK. And had she abandoned her career by this point, or was she intending to keep writing from afar?
She kept writing while she was there. She couldn't stop because she was so in debt. All the accounts of her poverty really coincide with William Jerdon's bankruptcy. She had not done enough to disentangle her finances from his, and in fact, I feel he was siphoning off her earnings.
Is she deluding herself, thinking that she can maintain a literary career from such a distance? I know that later on in the century you get Robert Louis Stevenson, for example, goes to Samoa and manages to keep sending things back, but then there's the technology of the telegraphs. Do you think it's possible to maintain a literary career from, you know, this castle on the west coast? She had it, basically, do you think?
She regarded writing as an escape. It was a way of not having to feel what she called feelings, if I have any. She's deluding herself while she's away in Africa. In fact, just after she's died, but before the news gets back to England, Robert Fisher, the editor of Fisher's Drawing Room Scrapbook, which represents one of her most steady income streams, is planning to sack her, and he writes to the poet Thomas Moore asking him to take over.
So at this moment, the big question is why? What happened? And I suppose maybe this is the question which goes to the heart of the book you've been working on, in a way. Is that right?
In a way. I mean, the death itself became a great sort of cause célèbre and a mystery in the public imagination.
So news travelled back quite quickly?
Well, it took until the 1st of January 1839 for the news to reach London. The obvious conclusion that you would come to if somebody is found dead with a bottle of prussic acid in their hand is that they've committed suicide. Nobody wanted to admit that this could possibly have happened.
Also at the castle, at the same time, or on the coast, there's been rumours that MacLean is still involved in some illicit dealings to do with the slave trade. Is that right?
As I've said, MacLean's appointment to his position as governor of Cape Coast Castle was made by the Merchant Committee, and he is in the pocket of this man, Matthew Forster, who's this incredibly wealthy businessman, very influential in the West Africa trade. Now we have to go and look in more detail at what Matthew Forster was up to. Because, of course, after the 1807 Abolition Act, the slave trade did not just disappear overnight. And one of the things that I've uncovered in this book, with the help of the work of other historians, particularly Marika Sherwood, who wrote a wonderful seminal book called After Abolition, is looking at what happened after the Abolition Act of 1807. British businesses did continue to be involved in illegal behaviour, particularly in contravening a later piece of legislation that came in 1824, which made it not just illegal to deal directly in slaves, but to have any trade or dealings with other people who were slave traders.
So you had the Abolition Act of 1807, and the 1820s, that's really bolstered by more legislation.
It's bolstered by more legislation. So under the 1824 legislation, you couldn't trade with a slave trader, you couldn't insure their ships, you couldn't have anything to do with them, even in the most abstract of ways. But if there was, unfortunately, the legislation was very poorly drafted, and it contained a loophole, which was that you had to have prior knowledge of the use to which your goods or services was going to be put.
And so at this time in the mid-1830s, has what you've found out demonstrated that MacLean was involved in this area?
After the abolition of the slave trade, the British forts on the west coast of Africa were almost a bit of a white elephant. I mean, you know, they'd lost their historical raison d'etre. The British had been threatening more than once to completely remove a military presence. The traders need the military presence because the region is plagued by tribal wars and they want to keep the trade routes open. MacLean is in a very, very difficult position. He was trying to keep everyone happy. The merchants, who were love-bombing him with basically bribes, the British government that was trying to pursue, although not necessarily wholeheartedly, a so-called sort of ethical foreign policy, as we'd now call it, by saying that MacLean had to sort of make sure that slave trading wasn't going on. And then, of course, MacLean is also, and this is where he's most successful, he's also having to have a relationship with the local nations, in particular the Fante and the Ashanti, who actually respect him an awful lot because it's greatly to their advantage to have a skilled independent mediator, and he succeeds in creating a sort of Pax Britannica that is appreciated by the local people.
This is a complicated marriage.
Incredibly complicated situation.
So here we are, they're only married a few months and they've travelled from London to West Africa, which in itself is a big thing to do. It's a bewildering change of scene for the poet. She's like unmoored, if you like, from everything that she knows. And her husband, meanwhile, is implicated in this illicit activity. And it just begs the question to me, did she know about this beforehand, or is this to her just like, is it too much?
Interestingly, the thing they really have in common is that both of them are on the receiving end of so-called slander. At the time they meet, she's had all this slander in the newspapers saying that she's a fallen woman. He's had slander, both from a whistleblower at Cape Coast Castle in letters to the Colonial Office and also increasingly in the press, saying that he is turning a blind eye to illegal trading. And I think in the period of their acknowledged engagement in London, it works because, in fact, they're not intimate, so each can be the other's propagandist. So she can go around saying that, you know, he's a great human rights crusader, trying to sort of, you know, improve the condition of the Africans. And, of course, he's not going to want to admit that she's a fallen woman, even though he, like her earlier fiancé, John Forster, has been probably sent anonymous letters.
That takes us on to our third scene. So it's Cape Coast Castle, the morning of the 15th of October, 1838. They've been married for 4 months. They've been in Africa for 2. But really, this is the day where everything comes to a head. Can you tell us what happens that morning, please?
That morning, Letitia Landon's maid goes in to see her in her dressing room, goes out to attend to some errands, comes back and tries to open the door. Difficult to force it open, and the reason is that it's been blocked by Letitia's body, and the maid finds her slumped against the door with a bottle of prussic acid in her hand.
So the immediate inference from that is, what, suicide?
There was an inquest later that very day in the castle, and the inquest jury was taken from the local members of the Council of Merchants. And they came to the conclusion that it was an accidental overdose, that Letitia Landon was taking prussic acid as a medicine and that she had told George MacLean that she had been prescribed it by her doctor in London. MacLean also testified that he'd been rather horrified to see her take this because it was a well known to be a very dangerous drug.
Yeah, what? I mean, maybe I'm showing my ignorance, but what would one use prussic acid for?
You know, it's a very good question. Prussic or hydrocyanic acid, as the name suggests, it's got cyanide in it, basically. Yeah. It was, however, in medicinal use in the early 19th century, although, in fact, by the end of the 1830s, nearly all the medical profession have given it up. But it was thought of as a sort of wonder drug when it was first discovered. Basically, it functions like a very, very powerful narcotic, and it was used as an alternative to laudanum. The difficulty with it is that the dosage, I mean, it's one tiny, tiny drop in a glass of water, and if you take more than that, it's curtains.
Right. And you did mention earlier that she had a history of using drugs. Is that right?
She did. And I think that she was using prussic acid because she was so addicted to laudanum that it wasn't working for her anymore.
So you don't think this was the first time that she'd used prussic acid? No.
Well, no, because George McLean testified that he'd seen her using it on the voyage out. And also another one of her, well, there's an anonymous article in the Times, which I think I know who it's by, one of her friends, also talking about her using prussic acid.
So, of course, you got the immediate response in the locality and in the castle, but how long did it take for the news to get back to London afterwards?
Well, the news doesn't get back to London until about the 1st of January, and almost immediately doubts are cast on the inquest verdict of accidental death. Her London doctor comes forward to say, I never prescribed prussic acid. How could she possibly have got any of this dangerous drug? But more interestingly, murder rumours start flying, and the person who is suspected of murder is McLean's African partner, his country wife, as they were called, because when he came over to England and met Letitia, he already had a long-standing relationship with Ellen McLean, who was mixed race, and she had several children it is reported that she had several children with McLean. However, she had almost certainly left the castle by the time Letitia got back there. The relationships between country wives and their men, which were unbelievably common at the time, because, of course, these European men would go there for years at a stretch. I mean, it's like the white moguls in India who would, you know, have a relationship with a local woman. And these relationships weren't casual relationships. It wasn't like Ellen McLean was his mistress. She was the sort of chatelaine of his house. But, you know, in a culture where polygamy was the norm, it was accepted that if the man went back to Europe, he might marry there, although the wife usually had to be compensated. What didn't really happen was that he'd bring his new European bride back to Africa.
Yeah, but the response in Britain must surely have been quite big because, I mean, even the subtitle of the book, you call her the female Byron.
Mm.
And that, of course, draws the obvious comparison with Byron's death, which was this enormous event. Oh,
yes. Well, I mean, she's not on a level with Byron. She's a wannabe Byron. She's not like Byron in that sense.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, it was front page news. Death of L.E.L., said the Leeds Mercury, which was the Bronte sisters' local paper, on the front page.
Okay, so, I mean, this whole podcast, I suppose, in a way, we use the conceit of time travelling to get us back to places. And often, you know, this is the historian's job, is try and get back as close as we can to the moment that the action happened to expose the truth of the story. Have you been able to establish what did happen that day, or have you found different sides of a testimony?
Well,
is that a textured scene?
It is textured. I mean, after the news got back to London, her friends went into print to send to the papers letters she'd written back from Cape Coast Castle, in which she seemed to be very... She said she was happy, the castle was a fine building, she doesn't suffer from the heat, insects there are few or none, it all sounds lovely. Actually, that was her final masquerade. It wasn't really like that at all. When a drug addict kills themselves with the drug that they're addicted to, the line between active suicide and, you know, reckless drug use is very, very thin. Although she did write two letters that disappeared on the morning of her death, and they could have been suicide notes. Certainly, there was absolutely no truth in the rumour, as far as I can see, that Ellen McLean had murdered her. But, you see, there are so many competing interests who all want a different version of the story, because the press with abolitionist sympathies is trying to find as much dirt as possible on George McLean and the merchants, because they're under suspicion for all this illegal trading. The doctor doesn't want it publicised. He's just recently become the first professor of medicine at the new London University. Doesn't want his professional reputation to be destroyed through inadvertently prescribed something that killed his celebrity patient. And also, of course, suicide is still a sin in the eyes of the church and a crime. Nobody wants to admit what's happened. And that's both the case with the people at Cape Coast, because they don't want any sort of... they don't want the spotlight of publicity on what the press has already called their dark nook of colonial dependency.
Yeah, is there any connection here with the other story that we've been telling, which is about the slave trade and the illicit tradings that's been going on in the wake of the abolition of that and this moment?
The connection, I'd say, would be that they instantly realise that this is really bad publicity at a time when they're trying to pretty much hide from the British government what they're doing.
So they're trying to stay under the radar.
They just want to stay under the radar. They do not want scandalous, exciting stories in the papers about prussic acid bottles.
And then all of a sudden they've got the most famous poet of the 1820s having died in a room.
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, what happened was that the British government finally sent out an official inspector to Cape Coast. He came back with a damning report saying, yes, you know, they're all up to the necks in it. But by this time, the government's changed and Matthew Forster has become elected as an MP, and he becomes the most assiduous member of the Parliamentary Select Committee appointed to look at this report. So, of course, he says it's rubbish because his company is being mentioned in it all the time. And by a few years later, Matthew Forster has become so arrogant that he quite openly says to a House of Lords committee that he knows of no merchant who wouldn't be proud and pleased to trade with slave traders. And in fact, you know, they go to enormous lengths. Once the maid gets back to London over a year later, she gets sort of intimidated by representatives of Forster and Smith, who make her go to a police station and sign a statement. They didn't want the spotlight of publicity, and they certainly didn't want the reputation of George MacLean to be in any way besmirched.
Right. I suppose the last question, if we were there, it's always a bit of a morbid thing to be at any death scene, in particular this one, which is a contested one and a very sad scene to look over. Do you just have an overwhelming sense of a tragedy reaching its conclusion with her life? Is that what this is?
Yes, I mean, it's almost as if she's been looking forward to this throughout her entire career. I mean, suicide is a huge theme in some of her early poetry, you know, in a sort of romantic death wish sort of way. And there are glamorous suicides in her poems, like Sappho, the famous ancient Greek poetess who throws herself to her death from a cliff because she's been rejected in love. There's nothing dramatic or glamorous about this befuddled final overdose. I mean, had she wanted to make a grand statement, she could have leapt off the castle battlements into the sea.
Let's zoom out a bit, because I think the truth of the matter is that people who are familiar with literary history in the early 19th century will have come across her work, but I don't think she's as well known as, well, for the reason that you pointed out right at the beginning, because her work is difficult to classify, she's a difficult character to pin down, and we have this long pause that we talk about. What happened to her reputation subsequently?
Well, I mean, within sort of, I don't think about 10 years of her death, the printing plates for the Improvisatrice, which had once been her bestseller, were melted down. By the end of the 19th century, she ceased to appear, really, even in anthologies. In fact, you know, you say people who know about the 19th century may read her now, but although increasingly she's appearing on some English university syllabuses and people are showing a lot more interest, you know, you still can't easily buy a modern anthology of her work, and none of it's in print. I mean, I actually bought a lot of original 1820s books from eBay, and one of them I even found in Oxfam when I was doing this research. Although one thing that I would love to promote is the fact that it's so possible these days online to read original manuscripts and printed books from this period, because they've been scanned in and you can just sort of click and turn the page.
Tremendous resource for the historian.
Amazing.
Isn't it?
So, you know, a lot of this.
Yeah,
I've
done a lot of this downloading from Google Books, put it on a Kindle and then you're off.
It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Archive.org is the absolute brilliant one.
And so she's to be found there for sure.
Definitely.
Well, let's talk a bit about the book before we before we wrap up, because LEL is soon to be out, within a few weeks, and I've found it an absorbing read. And I'd just like to know what your ambitions were and if they changed as you went through the writing of the book. What did you hope to achieve, and what do you think you got out of it at the end?
That is such a fascinating question, because I literally didn't know at the beginning of this quest what I was going to find. The one thing I did know was about the fact that she had these three secret children, because that information had been published in an article in the year 2000, although nobody'd known about it before, not until one of her descendants came forward. So I had this sort of idea that, well, here was this woman poet who tends to be thought of as a sort of, you know, sentimental virgin, and actually she had three secret illegitimate children. You know, maybe she was this, you know, really empowered woman having a very exciting sex life. But the more I got into the story, the darker and darker and more depressing it became. And
yeah, it is. It's a story of many twists and turns. That's for absolute sure. And for me, one of the, you know, the really enticing things about the book is that you bring together these two completely different worlds. You've got the world of literary London, you know, with Dickens getting underway and all of the, you know, the young and energetic publishing that's happening there at that time. And then you've got this dying, fading, really disturbing world, which is the end of the slave trade. And of course, people know about this, and there's been some really interesting work done recently. Have you been able to engage with that at all?
Absolutely. I mean, it was through looking at particularly the work of Marika Sherwood that I started understanding the levels of corruption that were going on at Cape Coast. And I mean, you say it was a fading world. It was a thriving world. There were lots of other nations like Portugal and Brazil that had not made the slave trade illegal. So there was an enormous transatlantic trade going on just down the coast.
Well, they talk about stories that tell bigger stories. You've certainly got one of those. And so I wish you all the very, very best with it on publication, which is coming around soon. And we do have a supplementary question, of course, which is we're coming back to 2019 now. And if you could bring one object back with you from that time, from 1838, what would you like to have with you?
I'd like to have the two letters that were left on Eliel's writing desk.
Brilliant.
On the morning she died, but that subsequently disappeared.
And do we know much more about them than that, or is it just a kind
we
of...
We know that
reference?
The maid gave them to George MacLean, and then they disappeared.
Well, fruitless to speculate, but, I mean, it's impossible not to do so. Well, but if you've got them, that's good. Thank you very, very much for travelling through time with us today, Lucasta Miller. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was me talking with Dr. Lucasta Miller at her publishers in London the other day. Thanks for listening into this episode of Travels Through Time. Please do leave us a comment or a rating if you enjoyed our chat or our time travel. I really do recommend LEL. It's a brilliant work of historical detection that takes two completely separate worlds, literary London and West Africa, and brings them together in a very strange and enlightening way. The book's currently being serialised on BBC Radio 4 as their Book of the Week, so you can catch up with narrated extracts on iPlayer if you like. We'll be back with another foray into the past in a fortnight's time. That's Tuesday the 28th of May. But from me and for now, that's it. Thank you very much for listening in.
I'm Paul Lay, editor of History Today. On our website, you'll find articles written by experts relating to Lucasta Miller's travels. You can read Malcolm Billings on Ghana's slave castles, Marika Sherwood on the problems with Britain's first anti-slavery act, while Gad Hoyman looks at slavery from the slave's perspective. Links to all of these pieces can be found at historytoday.com/travels. And there are many more articles on every aspect of the past in our monthly publication, History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine.